Today we have Sam Jordison, who's an editor, author, journalist, and also one of the co-founders of Galley-Bigger Press, a really cool also indie press that's making big hits at the moment as well and has done for a few years. It's my press as well, so please buy the books. So I think this will be an overview of, first of all, what Galley-Bigger Press do, the kinds of things also that might be interesting to you writers in terms of practical issues as well, submissions, that kind of stuff, expectations as well that we always talk about with Sam in relation to publishing. So I'll just give it to Sam, and again, mic's off unless there are questions. Okay.
Okay. Hey, thank you. Thanks to all of you for showing up. It's nice to have such a full virtual room. What can I tell you? Yes, I'm a journalist, as Gonzalo said, and a writer. I've written some toilet books. My mum calls them coffee table books, but they're kind of mainly silly, some quite serious, but mainly silly books that you might want to read in the smallest room. And also a publisher at Galley-Bigger Press. So I'm mainly going to talk about Galley-Bigger and who we are, why we are, and what it is that we're trying to do. And yeah, interrupt if you have questions, put your hand up, I'll try and get to you. I guess we'll have some time at the end as well. But let's why don't I start by telling you our kind of foundation myth. So we set up in 2012, so 8 years ago now, which is quite a while, I guess. And they say, if you survive for 3 years as an independent press, things are going okay. And fortunately, we've kept going, and things are going well in lots of ways. We can talk about some of the difficulties later on, and of course, the virus has made things complicated. But we set up in 2012, and my co-director and wife, Eloise Miller, is a novelist, and she also worked for academic publishers as a proofreader and wrote little bits and bobs of journalism about publishing as well. I mainly wrote about publishing and had been on the other side of the fence as an author in a way. And we had, lots of ideas about how publishers should be doing things. And I, for instance, was a 1990s indie kid. I don't even know if this means anything to anybody anymore. It's such a long time ago, but I loved. Oh my God, I could show you some of my records. I've never done this before.
Sub Pop.
I loved it. Sorry, wait me a second.
Are these the Sub Pop ones?
No, I've just found, like, the first one I found was Creation. So, like, I really liked Creation Records in the early 1990s, before they took on Oasis and went a bit lame. But and they put out like loads of really interesting stuff, and you never know. It was all different and eclectic, and so they did, like, the ones I've got here are Ride, which is kind of shoegazy, but they did Primal Scream and all sorts. And you wouldn't know what you were getting, but you would know that it was good, and you would know that it was created out of love for the music. And they had this whole aesthetic where you'd be able to recognize a Creation record leafing through in my little small record shop in Lancaster, where I grew up in the Northwest, and I loved that. And I liked 4AD, for instance, as well, which is the same thing. They'd have like the Cocteau Twins and the Pixies. If that means anything to you, they're completely different bands, but they come from, again, you know, they were just trying to push the envelope, create something really interesting and something that they were really passionate about. And I thought, you know, for a long time that didn't really seem to exist in publishing. And I wrote a few articles for The Guardian, for instance, about branding and publishing, talking about, I was quite mean to Faber and Faber, which I don't really regret. And you know, I would be, I said, you know, in the 19, in their glory years after the Second World War, you kind of knew, you would know that a Faber and Faber book came from somewhere and it really meant something, and you wouldn't know what you were getting, but they had really distinctive branding. You know, they had T.S. Eliot heading up the editorial and selecting really interesting authors and books, and they had their incredible poetry list. And now, if you look at a Faber book, you know, it could be anything, right? You just don't really know what you're getting. And you don't know what you're getting in terms of quality, and you don't know what you're getting in terms of cynicism in a way, because, you know, you don't know if you've got that book because an editor loves it or because they think it fits in a slot in the market. Which I'm sure, you know, if a Faber editor was here, they'd argue very passionately and be able to correct me on that. So take that with a pinch of salt. But that's kind of the impression I had, certainly back in 2012. And other things were going on. You know, we were coming out still out of the long recession of 2008, and publishing seemed to be in a kind of doldrums. Lots of people were talking about the death of the mid-list author, so great writers that. Do you guys know what I'm talking about if I talk about the mid-list author? So I'm getting seeing a few nods, but just in case, like a classic example would be Ian Rankin, who he put out four or five books that did reasonably well, but you know, not hugely well. And he's spoken about this really openly. He's really interesting. He said he kind of felt like he was gonna, you know, he was really pushing things because he hadn't taken off, but they stayed with him and, you know, kept investing in him, kept putting out his books. And then he put out a book called Black and Blue, which was huge. And now, you know, I've done some work at journalism with Ian Rankin, and there's a whole department of this publishing company devoted to him. Like, there are people whose jobs it is just to look after Ian Rankin. And you know, and that is the classic old-fashioned success story of the mid-list, where you stick with someone for a while and then every so often one of them goes supernova and it's great. And that feeding system seemed to have broken down a bit after the recession because publishers couldn't afford to keep people on, and it felt like they couldn't afford to take chances. And that really created an opportunity for small presses like us. And quite a few, we're not the only ones. I mean, there are other really good presses that set up around the same time who we were there to take risks, really. And we could, in a way, we could afford to take risks. And the way we could afford to take risks is that we can't afford anything. So we're so small that every book we put out, we're taking a massive chance on it. And, you know, in terms of the hours we put into it, the editorial, the love, and in financial terms, in terms of the print bill, it's always, even now, it's kind of, especially after Brexit, thanks guys, it's all become much more nightmarish again. Anyway, that's by the by. You know, every book you put out, it's a risk, but if every single book is a risk, you might as well take a proper risk and just dive in, you know, head first and really go for it. And so we have been able to put out books because we love them essentially, and to take risks on them on that basis. And I'm happy to say it's paid off. I guess one of the other things I should say is that, you know, we our philosophy is that we've believed in readers, and we've thought, well, if we like a book, other readers will. And one of the first books we put out was A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing by Emma McBride, which went on and won the Women's Prize for Fiction, the Baileys, as it was called then, did really well. And but Emma, it took her 10 years before it was published by us, And she would say that she got the most glowing rejection letters in publishing history. And the classic thing would be that editors would write to her and say, "Yeah, I love it, but the reading public's not going to go for this." And the marketing men have, and women, I suppose, but have said no. And there's some truth in that. Perhaps maybe they were also making excuses. And there were issues with Emer's book, especially the early pages, that it needed editorial attention, which is the other thing we can give. But essentially, before I get on to the editorial, we thought, well, if we like it, why won't other people? We don't have superpowers as editors. We don't think that editors are more able to understand and believe in a book than other people. So if Ellie and me love something, surely, hopefully, other people will. And that's possibly not always going to be true, but so far it's proved pretty true. So we've proceeded on that basis, and we've gone for the things we really like. And we've been around for 8 years. We've had quite a lot of prize nominations. We've had great reviews. We've had really good fun with our authors. It's been a lot of it's great. And I will be strongly recommending, if any of you are wondering about selling independent publisher, to go for it. And in a way, now is the time, because things are so much in flux and up in the air. And of course, there are risks associated with it and problems, but why not, especially at the moment? But what should I go on to editorial, or do you want to ask some questions?
Can ask some questions now, or we can go to editorial. I think I can't see any hands up or anything, so yeah, editorial.
Okay, so one of the things we do think we can offer our writers is editorial attention. So it's come to all knows we don't give great big advances. We give nice royalty rates and everything else, and try to really do justice to our authors. But we don't have massive amounts of money to throw around, but we do have time to put into editorial in a way that bigger publishers don't always have. And again, you've got to take this with a slight pinch of salt, because there are lots of really good editors at big publishers, and places like Picador, they're really careful. But their time is more limited, because an editor at a more normal publisher doing the editorial is kind of the thing that gets shunted around to the end of the day. They've got to go to all kinds of meetings. They've got to justify things to, I was talking about the marketing people before. They've got to spend a lot of time justifying what they're doing to that kind of people, and there's a whole chain of people they've got to keep pleasing. And Ellie and me, we don't really have that. And also, we're not getting paid in the same way. I mean, for a long time we weren't getting paid at all, but we don't have this quite have this time is money equation, because time is money, because we could be earning it in other ways, and of course it mounts up. But it's our time, and we can use it on the book. So we spend a lot of time really carefully reading through, putting in the input that we can. Which, on some books take years, and that's fine. Some books don't take much time at all. So I guess one of the first things, the secrets of editorial, is that there aren't rules, certainly not as far as I'm concerned. And other editors will tell you different. So in some publishing houses, they do have a system where they kind of have a first read, a second read, a structural read, and try and do things in quite a regimented way. But as far as I'm concerned, the book really dictates to you as an editor what you should be doing. And it's almost impressionistic, and it's based on what happens when you read it the first time, how things hit you, and then the different iterations of that as you keep going through it. So editorial is not a science as far as I'm concerned. It's more of an art. And what things can I tell you about what we're trying to do? I guess the main aim is it's about taking down the barriers between the writer and the reader, and that's what we really want, especially with the kind of books that we like, is that in a way you want the book to hit you at the back of the head almost, and you know, to feel like there's no interface between you and the writer's words. So a lot of editorial is just kind of taking away those little bits that snag at you and stop you feeling that impact, and that make your connection with the book seem more distant. And it can really take completely different forms. So sometimes it's moving odd words. I've got just the one that's on the top of the pile next to me, Lucia by Alex Phoebe. I like talking about the editorial on this because it's a difficult, emotionally difficult, challenging, complicated book. It's brilliant. Of course, I think it's brilliant. All our books are brilliant, but you know, it's really something intense and amazing. And it's written in this very fragmentary way, and it's about, among other things, you know, mental illness and the treatment or mistreatment of illness. And you know, its complicated fragmentary structure kind of reflects that in a way, and it's, things are disjointed and deliberately, and so it's bewildering in some ways. But the editorial was about trying to keep that aspect of it whilst also allowing readers to have something to follow and a way through this labyrinth in a way. And you know, I think of it, or it was about finding a way to get readers, raise them up onto Alex's level. So I kind of wanted to put a series of ladders in there. And it's, you know, I had a really great meeting with Alex where I was talking about this and saying you need a kind of through line structure and something to follow, as well as all of this stuff, and something that kind of ties it together, which, you know, you can say that as an editor, right? But much easier said than done. And the great thing, the brilliant thing about editorial is, you know, when you're writing with great writers, they go away and they just come back with something better than you can ever imagine. Like often they'll come back with something, some hilarious joke, or, you know, some great image that blows you away. And in the case of Lucia, Alex came back with this, like, just, I just couldn't possibly have thought of it, this overarching connecting image and continuing story of someone entering an Egyptian tomb and uncovering it and discovering that the tomb has been desecrated, because another thing the book is all about is the desecration of memory. And it's all about Lucia Joyce, who's James Joyce's daughter, who, you know, so her time period was the 1920s mainly, and Egyptology was huge then, and there were just all these completely brilliant ways that it fed into the story and developed the story. And you know, you just couldn't possibly have imagined it, but it was doing that essential thing that I think an editor should be doing, of giving readers not an easy journey. It's not about, you know, making things over simple or dumbing down, but you know, a map through the book, and it's very satisfying when that comes up. So we like doing that kind of thing. We like putting in the time with editorial, and also importantly, getting it right though. So you don't have to do that kind of thing with every book. And quite often, some the editorial is in fact just saying, yeah, that's fine. And often the best editorial as well comes from, you know, you make a suggestion to a writer and they say, no, that's not what I'm going for. And then they explain to you what it is they're going for. And then from that conversation, you get, a better understanding of the book, and you realize it's maybe something somewhere else in the book that's not quite going and getting clicking things into place. Which, I'm talking about this so much because, it's such a great part of the job, and it's so much fun. And it's where I think as a publisher we really are helpful. And the books that come out, I'd like to hope, are kind of truer to what the writers want to do, and help really set them up. And so that's that really. So we spend a lot of time on that. What else can I tell you about being a small press? We spend a lot of time on everything because you take a book from soup to nuts, as the expression is. So, from the moment you first realize that the writer has got this exciting talent up until long after it's come out in the shops. And a great thing about being a small publisher is you get, you find out about every bit of the process. So we know a lot about printing and paper grades, and typesetting is a big concern. Luckily, we've got a really great freelance typesetter who does things for us. Do you know what typesetting is? Should I? Yeah, not everyone knows. I'm
To
one tip
explain
of
it.
the iceberg. Yeah, so typesetting, I lo is like the magic hidden art of publishing. So the probably the simplest way to explain it is if you imagine you've got a Word document, and you do that thing where you give it straight margins down both sides, and it just means you get words that are massively spread out and it looks completely ridiculous and it's illegible. Well, most novels that you'll find, I don't know how clear this is on the screen, but they do have these straight edges, but they don't have those crazy gaps. And what the typesetters do is, by some weird hocus pocus magic, they actually have the different size gaps between all the letters and words, but you hardly notice because they've done it so carefully that everything just kind of evens out. And that's one thing, they choose this typeface to help it, to make it as clear as possible. And they design the page, and it's really a beautiful thing. Let me show you. I've got another one here. So there's this book that came out in 2019, which is, I don't know if you can really see, but essentially it's 1,000 pages, mainly one unending sentence. And an unending sentence is a huge challenge for typesetter because that stuff I was talking about with the gaps, you can normally do a lot with that with paragraphs, and you get room to play around with spaces. But Duck's Newburyport, this amazing masterpiece, doesn't have those. So our typesetter had to go in and break the program and reprogram it to make it work. So it's pretty great stuff to do. And the great thing about typesetting is, you don't really, again, it's to do with that thing of smacking the reader in the back of the head, or landing it at the back of the head, that you notice it on some level. You think, oh, that looks nice, but essentially good typesetting, you stop noticing it because you're just going with that flow, and they provide that. It's a really important part of it. What else is there in the process? Obviously, there's all the editorial, there's proofing, which kind of speaks for itself. We do a lot of work with distributors, and so they're the people that get the books out into the shops. And there's this fascinating side of the book world that is really old-fashioned, where there are sales reps who, in normal times, go around to shops with folders full of books and explain them to booksellers and try and persuade them to take them, essentially. And that still happens. It used to be that, the classic thing would be these guys going up and down the motorways in Ford Mondeos to shops all over the country. It's not quite like that anymore because Waterstones has centralized a lot of this stuff and there's fewer independent shops, but it still goes on. And so that's an important thing we work on closely with distributors. And of course, at the moment, all of that is in confusion, our warehouse. In fact, we've got quite a few orders through our website that we haven't been able to get out because the warehouse was closed because of COVID for a week or so. And there's all the complications of Brexit we're trying to deal with at the moment, which just it's just this unending nightmare. Like we haven't been able to post anything to Europe essentially since Christmas. And but you get involved with all those things, which obviously Brexit sucks, but all that stuff is fun. It keeps your day-to-day interesting and enjoyable, varied. So yeah, it's a good life.
I have been noting down some questions in case that I don't know if we should open to questions now. I think before we open to questions, it would be interesting. I remember on a previous talk we were talking about the expectations in terms of selling. I think it's always worth mentioning that kind of stuff. It's so interesting to actually hear from industry.
Okay. All right. This is going to be a slight bummer, but So the infamous statistic is that the average literary fiction title sells 260 copies. And then when you think about it, that is the average, right? Which includes, the real big hitters, the people who are selling hundreds of thousands of copies at the top. You see how small things are at the other end, I'm afraid to say. But again, that's something, as an independent press, we do well, and we've been getting much better at it as well. So we have a subscription, we call it the Galley Buddy Club, and we've now got we it actually it filled out. So we did limited editions of our books, these really nice, I think I've got a copy here, versions of them with black covers and nice flaps, and we always have nice paper, but they look and feel really lovely. So do our paperbacks. We try to make them as nice as possible. These are the ones for the shops. These are the ones for subscribers, and we now have 500 subscribers. So we had to stop taking subscribers for those because they wouldn't be limited editions anymore. So it means that every book we put out has at least 500 readers. In fact, more, because we now have a second tier subscription system for people who want the normal paperback. So that's really good. But yeah, the figures and the economics are difficult. And I could probably, I mean, obviously COVID has had a big impact on all of this. And in some ways, the book industry has got out of it comparatively lightly compared to other industries. And people have been reading, which is great. But with the closure of high street shops, it's just a disaster, really. And especially when it comes to breaking through new authors, it's really sad and difficult. And I feel so sorry for writers whose books come out and they can't see it in the shop. And, having a book come out is quite agonizing in all sorts of ways. And I know this from, having my own books out, that you kind of desperately go into the shop and the book isn't always there, and it's kind of a mixed feeling. But it's better than just not just like feeling like you're just chucking it into the void, which writers are feeling at the moment. So there are hard things about it, and it's hard. We remain the we're not going to fully understand the fallout until much later, I think. But I think it must be harder for debut writers to break through. And we've certainly found that, we had a book that has been doing fantastically well and still is, Morgy by Alex Phoebe, which is a different. Oh God, all my records are going to fall off. If you could see my desk, the glamour of independent publishing would soon wear off. I'm going to have to put things on the floor, in fact, the total chaos. Here it is. So this has been, was a word of mouth book, really. It got great reviews and stuff, but it was building in the shops, and then the shops shut down, and a lot of that momentum kind of disappeared. So those things have been happening. Yeah, there are challenges, but the other thing to say about publishing is there have always been challenges. And you can read Martial in ancient Rome complaining about publishing and how difficult it is. And every century there have been difficulties for publishing. It's always been precarious. And George Orwell writes these great things about being a reviewer, how little you earn and how hard it is for writers. And that there's a comparative golden age for writers. My God, like they actually earned a full-time living. But publishing endures, and it always has, and I hope it always will, because people want books. We supply a real human need, and it's a really good technology. Slight cuss on ebook readers, but they do some things well, but essentially they're a solution for a problem that doesn't exist, because books are great. A nice book is an unbeatable object and really nice to read and to hold, unless you have particular needs. I understand that if you have sight problems, for instance, ebooks are brilliant, so they're great for that. But most of the time I'd just rather have a book. And books endure, books bring an awful lot to people and will continue to do so. So despite the misery, there's always hope.
I mean, I was going to ask you about Amazon, but we have a question by Susan. Yes, I don't know if...
Hi, I'm sorry, I can't work out how to do the chat, so I'd have to ask you in person.
Oh. That's fine.
Could you just repeat the stat that you said about literary titles, the mean sales?
Yeah, I think I said 263. I'm now thinking it might be 235. Anyway...
Well, it doesn't matter. It's around that. Even if something comes out in paperback as a first publication, or is that just for hardbacks?
No, that's for the life cycle of the book. Yeah.
Yeah, if something comes out first as paperback, that still is. It would still include that, would it?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm afraid so. Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole shebang. Yeah.
So 230 something.
Yeah, roughly.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially round about the 250 mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's just quite remarkable.
Yeah. 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 It's hard. And that's why, what I was talking about with the midlist. I mean, Ian Rankin was selling more than that. But, it's a difficult one for writers. It's hard for publishers to keep people on when they're selling like 200 copies a time.
Yeah.
But it's what they need to do, really, because some of those writers will go on and start selling in big volume. Hilary Mantel's another good example, who really didn't sell very much and then sold absolutely loads. Anna Imran.
In a way, it's kind of encouraging, because I'm an early career literary translator, and the book that I've translated under the menteeship of Literature Wales, in its original language in Welsh, it sold 1400 copies.
Yeah.
So that, compared to that, is just like, wow, that is really encouraging, because that means that has done better in a minority language. That's a great stat for me to know.
That's really good. Yeah, I mean, 1400 is a lot by any standards, not just for literary titles.
But as in common with a lot of publications in Wales, it came straight out in paperback. A lot of books don't come out in hardback at all.
Yeah.
They just come straight out in paperback. This is why I was asking you about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, actually. I mean, our books, essentially, we have limited editions and paperbacks, but they come out simultaneously. And that model has worked really well for us. And we haven't really felt the need to put out hardbacks or seen why it would be useful. But that changed last year when we did a fantasy book, because it's a different market, and fantasy readers, there's a big part of them that really love hardbacks. And the way they generate word of mouth and kind of online forums and things. You kind of hope the hardback does that, and then the paperback comes out afterwards and builds on that. So they have a different kind of cycle. And it has been really interesting. I have to say, You know, the profit margin on hardbacks is higher, which is another reason publishers like to put them out. And it's part of the reason we didn't, in a way, because, you know, we didn't know how much value they were generating for readers.
Well, one thing that I found quite interesting over the last year while being mentored is I've spent a lot of time of that year reading books in translation from all sorts of other languages. And naming no names, but I did buy one that was hardback in translation. And the quality was so poor, I'd rather have had a good quality paperback than a rubbish quality hardback, and think and also then thinking, wow, I've paid $18.99 or whatever it was for this.
Yeah, it's
very true. I'd rather have paid $12.99 for a good quality hardback, a good quality paperback, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes paperbacks are just easier to read as well, but you know, a good quality hardback is a nice thing.
Yeah, a good quality hardback is, but I just thought, this is a bit like, I just felt that they were profiteering a bit. They use rubbish paper.
Sorry to intervene. To have time for more questions as well. Yeah. Thank you. And also, I mean, I have some of my own, but I'd be interested first on student questions as well. Yes, Ben.
Hi, I think, is that working? I can't tell.
Yes, it is. I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay, hi. It was just about setting up the press, really. I think it fascinates me. I love the fact that you made it analogous to setting up an indie record label, you know, with that connection and the agility that that gives you. And I wondered about the agility of, I mean, you touched upon it slightly, but things like print runs and whether presses are more flexible with print on demand and more flexible with print runs than they used to be or not?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. That's good. You know, print on demand, the short answer is yes. And some smaller presses do use print on demand pretty advantageously, and it means that they can monitor their costs and everything else. Not for us, because we want our books to come out in sufficient quantity that, you know, the economics of using print on demand just aren't there. We do pretty substantial print runs, and that's another great thing about a subscription. It helps us pay for those initial print runs and helps us really get the books out in the shop. And we want people to be able to discover our books in the shops, and so it's not part of our model, but I can see that it really works for some small presses. Like, there's a press that's really interesting called Dostoevsky Wannabe, who do mainly print on demand. Their books are really cool, but they're pretty damn niche. You know, you just wouldn't expect that many people to go for them. So it makes sense, I guess, for them. As to whether things are becoming more, we can put books, it's tricky. We have in the past put books together really quickly to try and get them out on time for something. And we have been able to do things with printers that other presses can't do. So Dux is a pretty classic example where the production Dux, it's not just a typesetting, it's getting it through the printers. Like, a book this thick is a challenge for most printers, and only a few printers in the UK that can do it. You have to have the right grade of paper. So, you know, what you want is paper that feels nice, doesn't go see-through too much when you turn the page, but is also thin enough that you can get 1,000 pages within the spine. So we spent ages, mainly my co-director, Ellie, getting the right grade of paper and working all these things out and really, really working on the production in a way that, again, in a more conventional publishing house, when you're working to strict timetables and that people only have so much on each job, they can't do that kind of thing. So we could put out, you know, Ducks felt like a kind of book that only we could put out, really. So we can do that kind of thing. We can change timetables, but you know, that presents its own challenges. The other thing we've been able to do, actually, and this is partly because, you know, our authors were super understanding, is when the pandemic hit last year, we delayed some of our books, which lots of publishers, they started doing it later than us, but we were just like, yeah, we're going to do this right away. And I think that paid off. And I don't know if you saw in October, like, just there was this crazy month when there's so many books were coming out because everything had to be delayed till October because publishers still had to get books out that year. But we waited. So there's the title Insignificance by James Clamer that was due out that last autumn, but isn't coming out in May now. And it feels like a much better time to have it out. And we were also able to hedge our books bets a bit on More Juice. So we changed its publication date to August when we thought hoped that the shops would be open and also that things would be quieter and it would get review space. And that paid off as well. So we can do that because, you know, we don't have as many people to answer to. We don't have as many books lined up. So if we move one, it doesn't have a massive domino effect further down the line. So we do have a certain amount of flexibility, yeah.
Excellent, thank you. I'm looking forward to Lucy Ellman's new book. I was lucky enough to catch the Things reading the other day, and it was just fantastic. Thank you for that. It's brilliant.
Oh, great. Oh, good. I think we'll see what comes back, but I think I just did the final edits on that today and sent it back to Lucy, and that is so good. I've spent a lot of time just laughing, and honestly, it's like plugging your hand into an electric socket sometimes. It's brilliant. You're just like, ah, so good.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben. And any more questions? If not, I'll ask one. We have one more question here. I think so. Elif?
Hello, yes, hi. Would you say that exophonic writers are more disadvantaged in terms of being published, especially because of the climate you've just described? Because you have to put more editorial work into their books.
So this is writers whose first language isn't English, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And who are writing in English?
Yes.
I mean, again, yeah, the short answer is yes. I mean, it's possibly harder. I'm afraid I can't remember what it was, but I did just see coming up in my Twitter feed just this morning, a writer who has just won some kind of prize. I'm really sorry for being so vague. And the thing the editor was saying, you know, this is great, especially since it's not this writer's first language. So it happens. And, you know, it's possible. It's harder. But sometimes, you know, it just depends on the individual writer and what they're doing. And I know this is going to sound like quite an archaic example, but, you know, Joseph Conrad, right? Just utter genius, and English was his third language. And part of the beauty and wonder of his writing is that he did have a different ear, and his rhythms are different, and the way he arranges things are different to most native English speakers. So it can be just a brilliant thing. So it's harder, and it's harder to get the grammar right, and possibly it needs more editorial, and possibly it will feel strange to native speakers to be reading a book that isn't written by someone whose first language is English. But it can be a tremendous advantage as well. It can be an absolutely brilliant, beautiful thing. So what am I saying to you? I think, you know, yes, it's harder, realistically, but it can be also your strongest suite. So it can be something that really, really works to your advantage. And there are lots of really good writers that have managed to do that and to find sympathetic editors. So it's probably worth trying. I mean, I do sometimes see manuscripts that are really interesting that are just a bit too hard to follow. And I have said to writers in the past, you know, maybe you should be writing this in your first language. And quite often it happens with, this is a huge generalization, but you know, it's just from my experience, like lots of Dutch writers who, you know, whose English is really good, but not quite fully tuned in. And I've said to a couple, you know, would it work better if you wrote it in Dutch first? But you know, there's no hard and fast rules about this. I don't know, does that clarify things for you at all? I know I just hummed and hawed.
No, thanks. At least you gave some hope.
And look, and of course, you know, his Gonzalo, We Are the End, was just a brilliant, beautiful, amazing book, and does, you know, it is different to probably, yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's different in sensibility and all kinds of things, you know, because Gonzalo's, you know, totally sees the world in, you know, in this brilliant, unique way anyway. But yeah, I think the rhythms there are slightly different. And that's one of the things I absolutely loved about the book. So there you go.
I do remember, though, having some issues in some scenes where the pluperfect tense, do you remember? There were some issues at some point with that. So I couldn't escape all the issues, but it was smoother. It was fairly smooth anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have, I guess, one question that could be of interest to, we have like 9 minutes just to keep track of time, but one question that could be useful for everybody else. So just in terms of imagining how this works, so when like how far along, because this is a question I think that I get even from students willing to submit to magazines or for publications for their books later on. One question is always, you know, I know it's not the last draft, but I think it's almost there. Should I be sending this?
Yeah, difficult question. I think, again, it depends. Is the true answer. You never quite know. And if you see the potential in something, great. But as an editor, you never want to step in too early. And in fact, we've got a book coming out maybe next year, maybe in 5 years, which is this absolutely amazing novel by one of our writers who's written a novel before, Paul Stanbridge. Who wrote a great book called The Forbidden Line, and he's written this amazing thing about grief, and it's incredible and just bursting with potential. But actually the first bit of editorial was to kind of talk to him about a few things in it, but then just say, you know, you go and do it, because he's got to work through the next draft by himself, I think, before I start sticking my kind of clodhoppers in. So that happens, but I mean, you want to get it as finished as you can. And I think you'll get to a point where you're like, I don't think I can go any further without someone, you know, that extra pair of eyes. You know, you feel like you maybe stop seeing things in some ways. And you know, when you're so involved with your book, you stop being able to see the wood for the trees and everything else. So, you know, comes a point where it becomes necessary to have an editor involved, I guess. And it's a hard decision to make when that is, and you've got to make it for yourself in some ways. Looks like Gonzalo's timed out for a second. Does anyone have a question? I'll see if I can come, if I'll see your hands. Valentina.
Hi there. I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah. Okay. My question is, what happens if you're a writer, but you also work in other areas of the arts? is it best to publish something in your own name as you are known in the other art field, or is it best to have like a pen name?
Oh, well, I guess the decision, I mean, it's up to you is probably the true answer, and what you feel is best for the way you work in your other field. I mean, chances are, if you already have a name somewhere else, that's going to appeal to publishers and to the public, because, you know, they've got something to know you by, and maybe you've already got a certain amount of a fan base or, you know, people who know and like what you do. So it feels like probably you should write under the same name, but, you know, people, there are all kinds of complicated reasons why people do use pseudonyms, and it's essentially up to you.
Well, this is what I was wondering. What is the value of, you know, working under another name? You know, I'm not sure. I know that Pablo Neruda published some stuff, you know, with a pseudonym when, you know, he didn't want certain poems to be read by such and such person. And so,
yeah.
I mean, I don't.
Yeah, in a way, you've answered your own question there. And if there's things you want to have out in the world but don't want associated with you in particular, I mean, what would be a good example? So, like, here's a tricky one, The Bell Jar, uh-huh. You know, by Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
She put that out under a pseudonym originally, and, you know, it's quite clear to see why, because, you know, the things, the writing about mental illness, especially when there's so much more of a stigma when she was publishing it, and but also about her mother, and she didn't want her mother to be hurt by the publication of the book. And, you know, it's quite a controversial thing that it did come out under her own name so quickly. So there's that kind of example. It might be that you've just come up with a cool pseudonym. I mean, there's, you know, what's another good example? John Le Carre.
Yeah.
Who, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is,
gone.
My name is way too long. See, and there's this, like in Chile, we usually have two surnames, and you don't want to omit one because we don't want to offend the dad, or we don't want to offend the mom. So we just keep both names. We use both surnames. So it's like my name is usually, like, it's just got so many letters. But I mean, in my other art field, which is music, I am known with those three names. Yeah. But it's like I just carry them around, just lugging these three names are so heavy. I just wonder whether it's better just to kind of do like a shortened version of those names, or just, you know, keep them as they are.
I think really that's up to you, I think, is probably the best answer I can do. Whatever you're comfortable with, it's your name.
Yeah.
You know, personally, I like a nice, long, sonorous author name. I don't think it would put me off, but.
Okay.
But, you know, everyone probably has different feelings about that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I like the fact that it's long. You know, I just think, you know, if publishers, they might look at it and think, well, that's got way too many letters, you know. I'm not going to have that big, you know, that doesn't fit in the spine or whatever.
Well, the spine challenge, that's interesting. I think, I don't know, play around with it, I guess, you know, while you're finding your way. But I don't think it's something you should worry about too much. I mean, your name's your name, and it's up to you, is my general feeling.
Well, good. So far, I've just used my name, and I've also had a, you know, few poems published as well, and I've used my full name. But I just wondered for the next thing what to do.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. I hope it goes well.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. I'm trying to see who else. Who is this? Oh, gosh. I hope I say your name right. Naoise?
Hi.
Hi. Did I say your name right?
It's Nisha, but no one can ever say it.
Oh,
don't
so
worry.
Sorry. I'm hoping
it's a name. My first poetry book's coming out later this year, and I just wondered if there's anything I can do to try and build the momentum you were talking about earlier as a writer.
Yeah, it's hard. Okay, so It's a poetry book, and who's it coming out with?
Nine Pens. They're fairly new.
Okay. What can I tell you? The honest truth is it's not easy. And one thing I should say is you shouldn't be beating yourself up thinking, oh God, I'm not doing anything. I'm not helping my book. My publisher's going to be feeling let down, or you know, you shouldn't be feeling guilt about not doing things is the important thing. Because there's a limit to what you can do, and there's a limit to what you can do without your publisher. And certainly, from our point of view at Galleybag, you know, it's great when writers can do stuff, and you know, they come up with really good ideas sometimes. But we don't want them to feel pressured to have to do something, because that's kind of our job, and it's kind of the reader's job in a way. It's the readers who help spread the word. But I mean, I guess one thing you can be doing is trying to get it to readers and trying to connect with people and see if they want review copies, for instance. It's really helpful as a publisher if a writer has good people that they know might be interested in the book. And I suppose, you know, I guess you have poets who do similar things to you, who you know, for instance, and, you know, speak to them would be perhaps a useful thing.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
Is that all good? Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Hope it goes well. James.
Hi. I was just interested in your publication of Mordu. I wanted to know about, like, what led to your decision to branch out into a different genre like fantasy, because I would imagine with a publisher creating that identity for your audience about what kind of genre you're trying to appeal to is sort of important. So it's just the fact that you decided to branch out a little from your literary sort of roster is kind of interesting to me.
It's a good question. It was a big thing for us. The simple answer is that Alex wrote it, and so Lucia, which I was showing you before, he's the author of Lucia, and he'd published two books with us before, which we just loved. And he started telling us about Mordu, and we were like, wow, that sounds great. And, you know, it was really lucky for us in a way that it was as much him standing by us as us publishing the fantasy in a way, because I suppose he could have taken it to a fantasy publisher. But we loved the book, and the first thing that came along was editorial, and you know, had some pretty definite ideas about that, so we were confident we could help him with that. And then we just thought, well, let's go for it. And you know, luckily it's paid off, and it's been really exciting, you know, finding out about how to make things work in a different world. You know, and it's a different world because it's a fantasy world, but a different world because there are different parts of the reading community that we've been reaching out to. And you know, luckily for us, it's turned out that the fantasy world has been really welcoming, we've had great coverage in like Locus magazine and these SF and fantasy places, Interzone. It's so cool to be in these. I've got it here because I'm so pleased. Like, it's totally ace. SF and fantasy magazine that did a really good review. And you know, and we've just worked hard at it, like we do with all our books. Ellie has done loads of contacting people. I had a few good contacts because in my journalism I've written about SF quite a bit, so we sort of thought, you know, we weren't going in completely blind, but it was something different, and we had to work out, you know, spend a long time thinking about, for instance, the cover I was showing you and how to design that and how to find the best artists. And in fact, to have cover art was a big decision, because we don't normally. But, you know, luckily, like at all our books, it was a risk and a gamble, and luckily for us, it's gone well. But you are right. It was kind of a right turn. I suppose the other thing I should tell you is that we were so confident in the book. We just thought it was so good. And we thought that, you know, the people who like our kind of books and read Kalibeger books would also like this, because it's beautifully written. It's, you know, it's full of ideas. And, you know, so we kind of, in a way, thought, you know, we're going to get a bonus readership, because our normal readership is going to like it, and we might get this extra readership as well, I suppose. So that's why we didn't feel too frightened. Does that answer it?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thanks.
Cool. Thanks. Is that anyone else got a question? I think Gonzalo's back. Hey, are you there? I don't think he's made it. Hey, listen, it's been really nice speaking to you, and thanks for your interest and the really, really good questions. And I hope things go well for you. I know it's a strange year, but I hope you've got reason to hope as well. So nice speaking to you.
I did make it in the end. So.
Oh, hey, man.
Sorry, that took a while. I did listen to the last few questions, but I was on my phone for some reason. Sorry about that. It just was a massive outage. But yeah, thank you. Thank you to everyone as well for coming. And thank you, Sam, as well. And yeah, hope you found that useful. It will be recorded for those who couldn't make it later. So I will... you can always go on the page with the archives on the webpage just to check them out. Cool.
Oh, thanks awesome. For having me.
Thank you, Sam. Cheers. Bye.
All right. Bye.